Everyone, you know. So, good evening, everyone. So, I don't know how much time you all have this evening, but I was thinking maybe give a talk for about 45 minutes. And then, if anyone would like to ask any questions or have any discussion after that, then I'm very happy to carry on as long as. So I like to start off by telling a story. I'm very fond of stories. This is a very old story about a stonemason working in a quarry in a mountain on the mountainside. It's kind of hard life. And one day the stonemason heard some commotion down on the road and looked down, and there was a small procession with a palanquin with the senior civil servant being carried you know what a palanquin is, don't you? So, okay. And he thought, what a life. Wow, you know, just wherever you go, get carried around, don't have to work out, work so hard like this. Oh, I just wish that I could have a life like that. And suddenly, like this, and he's become the civil servant in the palanquin. Incredible. So he's sitting there, and then they get to the town, and he has to stand in the town square and give all his judgments about things, and lots of people there, and it's really, really hot. He's sweating away, and he says, well, this wasn't not quite so much fun as I thought. Not so great being a civil servant. You're just at the mercy of the sun, just like anybody else. And then he thought, wow, I'd really like to be the sun. So this is, I don't know the physics of this, okay, so, but he's a poof, and then he became the sun. So you just have to bear with me a bit here. So he's the sun now, and he's, wow, you know, so much power. He can just blaze out and make people as hot as he wants or do whatever. He's like, all the planets just revolve around him. He's number one. So then he thinks of some people that he didn't get on with very well when he was a stone cutter, and decides to make them really hot. He sends some real strong rays of sun down, but it just so happens it's the rainy season. There's clouds in the way. The sun can't get through. And he thought, wow, you know, here I thought I was number one, the most powerful figure in the universe, and a cloud can stop me. Can thwart my desires. Yeah, I want to be a cloud. So he becomes a cloud. He says, what a life, just float around, you know, just nobody tell you what to do. Great life. Oh, so wind blows him away. I say, oh, yeah, it's no freedom. You know, it's this just totally at the mercy of the wind. That's not such a great life, being a cloud. Ah, the wind, there's a life, you know. So, whoo, just blow wherever you want to go. And you can go fast, you can go slow, you can go up, you go down, yeah. So, boom, he becomes the wind. He's having a great time being the wind. And then he blows, and he comes up against a mountain. And the mountain is just completely imperturbable, uninterested, unchanged. And the wind is completely powerless. And so I think, yeah, mountain, that's the thing to do. That's the thing to be, a mountain. Right from the top, you can see for miles, and everyone looks up at you, and great life. So it becomes a mountain. So there he is, he's a mountain, he's feeling so great, and then he's, whoop, whoop, bop, bop, bop. And he looks down, and there's a stonemason banging away, disturbing his peace. He says, yeah, maybe I'll just be a stonemason. So this is an old Chinese story, but it's obviously timeless in its application, in that once that comparison with others starts to find root in our mind, and discontent soon follows. And we're living in a world where the most minor of disturbances can become magnified through the power of media and technology. So, you know, if you were if you were living as a woman, maybe 100 years ago, maybe there'll be a few women, one or two women, maybe, who are more attractive than you are. You feel a little bit bad about it. But now, through advertising and through magazines and through media, every day, you know, you're confronted with people who are more beautiful than you are, smarter than you are. Men, we're surrounded with people who are more handsome, more powerful, more intelligent. So if we get that comparison, discontent bug in our minds, it's very hard to stop it, isn't there? And of course, when we look at other people, you know, we rarely stop and just think how unrealistic our perceptions of other people are. I think that I'm sure you've all had that experience of going to a beautiful place, some maybe go on holiday somewhere abroad or somewhere that you always wanted to go, and always thought it'd be a fantastic place for a holiday. And then you get there, and maybe you have an argument with your spouse or with your children. And although if you were to take a photograph, you know, or post something on Facebook or something, you know, it'll look really great. But actually the beauty of the surroundings mean nothing, because you're totally miserable and bound up with the emotions of the conflict with a loved one. And when we see people in beautiful places and having what seem to be enviable experiences, then we tend to forget that the context of our lives are rarely the main determinant of our sense of well-being. It's much more our relations with the people around us, and of course, most importantly, our relationship with ourselves. And with the emphasis on communicating through devices and technology these days, in many cases, our ability to relate to those around us is becoming less sophisticated, less wise, let's say, less sensitive. And most importantly, I think in this age of distraction, you know, we've never in history of humankind have we the opportunity to distract ourselves from our from our lives that we do now. So the moment people get bored, people get upset with something, they have immediately the telephone or some means of going off into a different world and of not facing up to their problem and the cause of their problem. So in certain cases, you know, maybe better than nothing, and don't begrudge people that exit or that way out when the people are really suffering. We have compassion for that. But as Buddhists, we need to keep returning to the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth, of course, of suffering. And suffering is something which needs to be comprehended. So each of the Four Noble Truths has a duty or a responsibility that comes with it. So the first noble truth of suffering is something to be comprehended. So if our normal default strategy of dealing with suffering is turning our back on it or trying to distract ourselves from it, then although we can get through the day, get through the night, and just suppress things and repress things, then we're never really dealing with the problem itself and problems that are created by the ignorant mind. So it's when we have that courage and interest to stop and look at what's going on that we can start to understand how craving conditions suffering and how we can do something about it. So this is the heart of Buddhist practice, isn't it? So the that interest in our life, basically, and the pressures of modern life are such that we have so many different roles to play, so many responsibilities as sons, daughters, brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, friends, employers, employees, citizens, so many different hats that we have to wear or masks that we have to put on sometimes. And that's very burdensome, isn't it? And particularly when we feel how important it is, let's say with raising children, this is something that's not just affects us, it affects our whole, our family and our lineage and our, and the ones that we care about the most. So, how do we deal with that? And I think that meditation practice plays a very important role in that, in our daily life, we are always having to be somebody for somebody. And in meditation, we have this delicious, wonderful experience of being nobody. And I think in our life, we often talk about like the work, play or work relaxation, balance, but this I think is a more essential, more profound balance, the balance between being somebody and being nobody. It's not that you want to be nobody all the time, but having that experience of being nobody and having access to that and being able to bring that to mind just a little bit more perspective on all the people that you have to be and all the expectations that other people have for you and in you, and maybe expectations you have for yourself. The So a lot of meditation practice, I think, is this, it's observation. You know, we're looking to create an environment in which we can learn very directly from our experience. And so if we take a meditation object such as the breath, then what happens? Well, before very long at all, and this is not dependent on our developing deep states of meditation, but there is no perception of ourselves at that moment as we're being mindful of the breath, the in-breath, the out-breath, and we have no perception of ourselves as being this person with this biography and these hopes and fears and pressures and expectations. We don't even have a sense of ourselves as being male or female, being a good person, a bad person. They're simply the body and the mind. And I would argue that this is, in fact, you know, what is, like we could say, the real world. You know, so people bandy this word around in a very careless way, and often the people with the least interest in spiritual development who are the most confident that they know what the real world is. You said the world of making money and the world of cutthroat competition and so on, you know, this is the real world. But when we meditate, you know, we understand, no, this is the real world. This is the world of direct experience, you know, this body right now, this mind right now, form, feelings, perceptions, thoughts, emotions, sense consciousness. This is the real world. Looking on meditation as a way of just returning to our roots and returning to the real world of this being, this existence, and the arising and passing away of the various elements of body and mind. And really observing and noting that freedom of being nobody in particular. And then when we emerge from that world and we assume our various responsibilities, and I think we can do it with a lighter heart. It's not such a heavy thing anymore. So I would compare the life without this, the meditative perspective, as like two-dimensional life, and the life which is enriched by the practice of meditation as being three-dimensional. So it's not like a completely different realm, and you close your eyes and you just forget about everything, go and live in a different kind of happy place for a while. But it's providing this third dimension, giving a new and clearer perspective. It's very easy in meditation practice to become result-oriented or to be kind of either-or. What I mean by that is to assume that a successful meditator or a successful meditation requires a certain level of peace and calm and clarity. And if you acquire that, you achieve that in a meditation, then you're a good meditator, or you've had a good meditation. And if you don't, then you're not a good meditator. And some people start to feel really inadequate or maybe completely discouraged. But I believe this is not a very healthy or wise way of looking at meditation practice. So first of all, Why do we concentrate on an object, or why do we focus on a particular meditation object, such as the breath, for example? I mean, why? What's the logic behind it? And I would like to suggest that it is in order to illuminate. The first stage is in order to illuminate the normal workings of the mind. So most people who begin to meditate, it makes you feel even more agitated than before, sort of less peaceful than before you meditated. But of course, that's not the case. But you are becoming conscious of all the things that are going on in your mind. So let's compare it to someone floating on a raft down a huge river like the Amazon, where you can't see either of the banks. So you're just on this great expanse of water, and you're just floating along with the stream. Now, if that's the case, it's almost impossible for you to have any idea of what that stream is or how strong that stream is. The only way you can get that kind of information is by paddling against the stream. So when you paddle against the stream, you become immediately aware of how strong that current is. And our minds, the stream of the mind is generally one just jumping around from memory, imagination, desire, fear, and so on. But we're so used to it, so familiar to it, that we have no sense of how dysfunctional that is and how unhealthy it is. And the way that we can become awake, we can awaken to that, is by countering that, of going in the opposite direction. So from the mind that loves variety and change and stimulation, we give it a single object, a single focus, and see what happens. And of course the mind goes crazy. It doesn't like it. It's like a wild horse or a wild animal. But when that happens, that doesn't mean that you're not doing it right, or there's something wrong with you, or you're not a good meditator. This is precisely the result that is intended, because we can only truly transcend negative emotions, defilements, when we understand them, when we're fully aware of how they arise, and what feeds them, and what starves them or undermines them, and how they pass away. In other words, how to prevent them arising in the first place. And when we are unsuccessful in prevention, then how to eliminate these hindrances. Now, as I said, it's not that these hindrances arise because we meditate, but they're being revealed. We're shining a light on them through the practice of meditation. So it's a learning process. We want to learn about how our mind works and how we create unnecessary suffering for ourselves, and how we can educate ourselves so as not to have to do that anymore. And the reason that an object like the breath is particularly powerful, and has been a meditation object used by the Buddha himself and many of the great masters of from the time of the Buddha up to the present day, is because it's not interesting, is it? It's boring. I mean, that's the point. So you watch a movie, can't you, like for 2 hours or something, and you can sit completely still, no physical discomfort, completely. Is that samadhi? Well, you know, you have no thoughts of the past, no thoughts of the future. You're completely wrapped up in, is that samadhi? If not, why not? Yeah. So my answer to this question would be that there's no effort involved. So samadhi, there has to be effort. And the reason that we can watch something for an hour, 2 hours, or whatever it is because we are being led on, we're being stimulated, we're entranced by the narrative, the story, the emotions that are being stimulated. So there's a flow and there's a variation, constant variation in what we're watching, even though it's all manifesting on a screen. But when they've done some like MRI scans of people watching TV or movies, the brain waves are almost identical to someone in the state of hypnosis. So it's almost a completely passive, you know, although you may sort of feel a lot of emotions and excitement and so on. In terms of what's going on in your brain, it's a passive, you're just being led along, and you don't need to make any kind of effort. But when you have, you take the breath as your object, you know, there's no way that your mind is just going to stay with the breath and just enjoy the breath without you putting a lot of work and effort into it. It's going against the grain. And that's why it's an important tool, in meditation, because you have to, you have to be really smart, and committed and dedicated and to be able to do it. It's not, I'm sure you've all noticed that you can't just force your mind to be on the breath. And the, a few minutes ago, I spoke in terms of a training, education, a learning experience. And there are all kinds of life skills that we're learning right from the very beginning of meditation. So one of them is, learning how to motivate ourselves. So unless we can, create an understanding of what we're doing, a framework, that will, provide or lead to some sense of inspiration, and interest and enthusiasm for what we're doing, then the meditation will always be up and down. And it's natural for us, isn't it, to be looking for inspiration outside of ourselves. Sometimes people come to see me in Thailand and say, you know, I like to listen to your talks a lot, and I feel very peaceful. And I listen, and then when I turn it off and meditate, then I'm not peaceful at all. So is it all right if I just listen to talks rather than sit in silence? And I say no, because you know that's the talks are to help you to create that sense of interest in practice. But it can also be a crutch, isn't it? I mean, how many times, you know, you're having some difficulty with your meditation, or you get a bit bored, listen to Lumpur Sumedho for half an hour, or read a book or something. So these things are wonderful. You know, we're so blessed in this day and age to have Dhamma books and we can, switch on and switch off the sound of great monks. So, you know, exactly, you know, we just listen just exactly as much as we want to listen, and then we can turn them off. So, you know, nobody ever has been able to do this in the past 2,500 years. You can sit in your car and say, which arahant shall I listen to on my way to work this morning? You know, people would be amazed even 50 years ago, 100 years ago, to have that kind of opportunity. But these are real advantages, but they can also be crutches. And we have to be very honest with ourselves when we're looking for some like Dhamma hit. And we are a bit dishonest with ourselves, or we lie to ourselves a little bit, to be frank, that because it's the Dhamma, it's not distraction, you know. But we can be distracted by Dhamma just as we can with listening to music or some other more worldly enjoyment. So it's that knowing your intention is important. But the skill that we should really be interested in developing is that one of wise reflection and developing the ability to change our thinking and to pursue a path of reflection that will bring up that enthusiasm when it starts to wane and starts to flag. So sometimes, you know, with children, school children, and complain about, oh, it's boring. This subject is so boring. You know, it's just a perennial moan of the teenager. It's boring. It's like, my response to this when children say this is, I say, if something's boring, it means you're not smart enough yet to make it not boring. Because there's, you know, like, sugar is sweet. You know, anyone who puts some sugar on their tongue, you'll have the same sweet taste, and salt is salty. But it's quite obvious, isn't it, that not everything is perceived as being boring. Some people find it totally boring, and some people love it, and some people like it a little bit or don't like it a little bit. But there's a spectrum of reactions. So there's not something inherently boring in anything, which shows it's the importance of how you frame it, how you're looking at it, what you're expecting from it, what your understanding of its value to your life is. And this is a skill, a life skill, that can be developed and then should be developed. And that's a wonderful feeling to feel you have that kind of resource. You're not expecting, or you can't be inspired all the time. And you can't expect to be inspired all the time. Even monks are not inspired all the time, you know. You're going to have ups and downs, and it's all right to have the downs as well, and sometimes some doubts and some tough times. But at the same time, it's something that you can work with. You know, it's like you sort of slowly massage things. When you get into that kind of bored or kind of stale state of mind, then that's also part of the practice. It's not like something outside of, I can't really practice now, I feel really restless, or I feel really bored, or I've lost my interest, but that's where you practice. You see, because the practice is understanding dukkha, understanding how dukkha arises, finding skillful means of dealing with dukkha. So there's nothing outside of your practice which is pulling you away from your practice or making your practice particularly hard, because it's all practice. Excuse me. So the meditation is, you know, is the vessel, and this is how you're the challenge to be able to deal with the ups and downs of the emotions and how you feel about your practice. So you feel your practice is going very well, you feel your practice is not going so well these days, or you feel you're in a bit of a rut, or you feel this. These feelings are part of the practice. They are the practice. And as we observe, we tend to realize how unrealistic our own assessment of our practice can be. You know, you're on a retreat, for instance, and you have like a really distracted and totally tough hour or so, and then, you know, you're ready to go home and you've had enough, and it's hopeless, and don't know why you even bothered coming at all, waste waste of time, and like just that kind of spiral downwards. And then a couple of hours later, you sit again, and everything is just really, oh. And then you say, why has he ringed the bell so, I could have sat here for, whereas before, he said, come on, he's going to ring the bell, he's going to ring the bell. And now it's just the direct opposite. Well, I'd only just started. And then you can suddenly think, well, oh, yeah, I think I'm going to be a monk. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And within, just within the space of a couple of hours, you just want to give up altogether. And next, maybe I can make it to Nibbana in this lifetime after all. That's part of the practice, observing that and just smiling at it a little bit, not taking it so seriously. Mm. So, learning the skills of self-motivation and finding reflections and ways of looking at things that you find particularly powerful, and have like a, these days we say like a database, something that you can just very easily bring to mind. So traditionally, when we're reflecting on the qualities of the Buddha, of the Dhamma, of the Sangha. With the Buddha, if you've read suttas and you have some familiarity with the life of the Buddha, if there are particular stories and particular episodes that you find profound and uplifting, then that goes into your database. That's something that you can bring to mind. And then, of course, with the Sangha in particular, remembering and bringing to mind the great monks and inspiring figures that you've been fortunate enough to hear or to speak with or to pay respects to, and to remember that all of those great monks and nuns and teachers, laymen, laywomen, they all started off, every one of them, with confused minds. They didn't, they weren't sort of pure and peaceful right from the beginning. They got where they are now through effort. And there's no reason why you can't put forward that same effort. So when we recollect great spiritual teachers, there are skillful ways, unskillful ways of doing it. Sometimes we put the teacher up on so much of a pedestal and then we humble ourselves and some of the gap between them and us seems so huge that rather than uplifting, it can be a little bit depressing. But then when we recollect that, they started off, they had problems as well, difficulties, obstacles, defilements. But they overcame them through effort and through patience and through resilience and so on. And Ajahn Chah, Lumpur Chah, is particularly well known for his honesty about his own difficulties as a young monk, and how he struggled to overcome them, and he. And so many of the monks who lived with him in those days found that was so inspiring to them, that their teacher, who they looked up to and revered, was saying, "Yeah, I was like you, and I came through it. And if I can, you can." So recollecting the Buddha, the Dhamma, particular teachings of the Dhamma. all meditation techniques, sometimes they're called samatha, sometimes they're called vipassana, some of this. Basically, whatever the technique is, it flows together at the point where we call, the Nepali word is pamoja, which is the precursor to piti, or to rapture. But it's this intense sense of well-being. This is what we call pamoja. And whatever meditation technique you're using, then if it's going in the right direction, their will, get this sense of pamoja. And when we meditate on the breath, sometimes the mind's just not ready for it. It's just too much for the mind, particularly if you had a very busy day or busy mind, and it's just too much to go from the whole momentum of thought and busyness, and suddenly sit down in the evening and expect your mind just to be able to let go of that. I mean, if you can, wonderful. But for a lot of people, it's really tough. And there are some things you can do before you sit which are helpful, just to have a shower, maybe do a little bit of yoga, just a little bit of loosening up, or Tai Chi, Qigong, something like that. These are very good ways of just loosening up and letting go of some of the daily stresses and strains. A little bit of chanting is also a very good transition into a new mode being. Nevertheless, there are times when the mind is this kind of craving for more, something going on in the mind, and it's too much for the mindfulness to deal with. In that case, then the discursive meditations are helpful to begin with. So it may be reflections on death, the various reflections about the certainty of death, the uncertainty of the time of death, the uncertainty of the kind of death, and the various ways of reflecting on death, or investigating the 32 parts of the body, or reflecting on acts of a particularly powerful one, and one that I recommend particularly for elderly people. If you're teaching elders towards the end of their life and they've never meditated before, and it's just too much to expect them to be with the breath, then to encourage them to recollect the good actions that they performed in the past, things that they feel proud of. And you can write some down and encourage them to think like number one, number two, number three. But if you find the ones that are very, that really bring up some joy and wholesome pride, then to focus on them. So with these kinds of meditations, particularly the ones that bring up this sense of wholesome joy, then they can suppress the hindrances and mental agitation very quickly, in a way that struggling with the breath may not be able to. So you can use these thinking meditations. So you're thinking systematically within boundaries that you've established for yourself. And then the positive emotion that arises suppresses the hindrances, and then you can go to the breath after that, when the mind is settled down through the discursive meditation. This is this morning I was speaking a little bit about the link between the inner and outer world and inner and outer practices, and how practice of generosity changes our perception of ourselves, and we become aware of ourselves as givers. It is a fundamental evolution, if you like. So just a bit of a memory I had. I found myself in a rather strange situation a few years ago. I was visiting our monastery in California, and I was invited by the Buddhist group in Stanford University to give a talk in the evening. And Stanford's near, in a place called Palo Alto. And there's one part of Palo Alto which is very poor and has a lot of problems. And I was invited to go and meet with a, kind of the elders, kind of an elders council of this rundown part of Palo Alto by a young Indian man. Little did I know that it was all his idea and nobody else knew anything about it. And so I walked in and I said, who's this? You know, it was very, very polite. And so it was a bit of a funny kind of situation. But anyway, they asked me what, from my perspective, you know, how to do something to raise the tone of this, to go get out of this sense of hopelessness and despair and anger that was so prevalent in the poorer parts of their town. And I told them about Northeast Thailand, where, you know, when I was first there in the late 70s, it was very poor. And yet we'd go on alms round every morning, and so many people would come out to put food in our bowls. And almost everyone would only put sticky rice in our bowls, because that's all they had. But what I noticed was, even the poorest shack, you know, the people don't have any money in those days. I mean, no bank accounts, no living basically day by day. But everybody would have rice. And so people, many of you have been to Northeast Thailand, so you know this, and have like a plate and a bowl of sticky rice, and they see how many monks come, and they divided it into 5 or 6 or 7 little lumps, and then each put a lump in each bowl. And I could see, like, even for the poorest person in the village, they started off their day with an act of generosity, an act of giving, and a sense that they were contributing in a very tangible way to the well-being of the Sangha and to their religion. And this is why you never see that sense of that in the West are called, like, the lack of self-esteem of people living in great poverty, because they had the sense that we're givers, we're people who give, we share, and that gave them a lot of joy. And so so I was saying, you know, this is what I think is most uplifting in a community where people are given the opportunity to give, and where giving is not measured in terms of, like, the amount of money or what it is, but this is the very act of giving and sharing, and some creating some some kind of platforms for that. So when we give, and when we give, particularly when we give without any desire for any kind of reward, the Buddha says that becomes what we call a noble treasure. And to explain that, I'm sure in all of our lives we've had times where we have given things with some desire for something or other in return. And other times when we've given in a very pure way without that desire. But now, if you bring those two things to mind, now, if you remember an occasion where you gave something with, and it made genuine sacrifice, but with some catch, something that you wanted in return at some time, now when you think about it, you just feel kind of indifferent. You know, the sense, the memory in your mind is basically of a transaction. But when you remember something that you did, without any desire for, you don't even want anybody to know, you just did it out of the purity of your heart, you felt sorry, you felt compassion, you felt inspired, you want to support something that was good and wholesome in your community or in your religion. And then you can see that 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years afterwards, the moment you think about that makes you feel good immediately, no question. So talking about what's like a lot of merit or a little merit, this is how you can see, afterwards when you think about that, what is the emotion that arises? And so that the Buddha says that's a noble treasure of the mind, where you just immediately feel, yeah, whatever, I've done some stupid things in my life, made some mistakes, but yeah, I'm really glad I did that. That's, nobody can take that away from me. That's something, I can say, yeah, I did that. And that's something that you can make use of in meditation. Because when you're feeling a little bit low, a little bit stale, and just consciously bringing the memory of those good actions and that goodness in your life into the present moment, and allow yourself to dwell on that. And that can really effectively deal with hindrances in the mind, and allow the mind to go on to, if you wish, to the meditation on the breath. So constantly working with the mind in meditation. Sometimes people say, "I did this, I did this, and I did that." Then it had a really good, bright, calm meditation. Is that all right? I said, well, if it worked, it's all right. You don't have to get, a monk's approval of it. You know for yourself whether or not. It doesn't have to be in any of the books, to get the stamp of approval. You work and with what you got, and you find how looking at things in certain ways works, and how what prevents defilements arising in the first place, and what reduces and eliminates them when we can't do that. So again, in terms of meditation as a learning process, as an exploration, as a way of illuminating all the things that are not peaceful in your life, rather than thinking you can just bypass all those things and just go straight into this state of bliss and peace. Long term, you have to really understand how all the non-peaceful elements in your life work, and why we're still so addicted to them. Because if there are some particular habits of thought and negative emotions, there has to be something in there that you really want it to be there. You can say, I want to be peaceful. But no, you also want the non-peaceful. So you want to be peaceful without giving up all the non-peaceful things. That's basically it. You want to have your cake and eat it. Like anger is good. How everybody knows it's not a good thing. It's bad. You get angry, but there's a real attraction to anger, isn't it? And traditionally, for a woman, for thousands of years, nobody really pays you much attention. Men, you say things and men really not interested. They don't give you much credit. Things are changing now, but so what's the one way that if you're a woman, you're physically smaller, you're given no credit for your mind and your intellect, what's the one way that people will pay you attention? Get angry. You see that's the charm of anger, isn't it? People take you seriously. See that there always has to be a hook, otherwise you wouldn't have that in your life, because it's so toxic. But that sense of power that anger gives you, that sense of people taking you seriously, there's something attractive in that, obviously. and the only way that we can abandon defilements, like I say, is to be able to see both the toxic dimension, the suffering that things bring in your life, but also what it is you like about it. Why is it that you're not yet willing to let go of that? There has to be something in there. There's a hook, and you have to be aware of that hook as well. So practice is a learning a learning experience, and it's also, I would say, it provides a very efficient feedback system. So like Holy Grail of sportsmen and people in arts of most creative endeavors is this sense of flow or of a balance of effort and relaxation. You know, in the world, people, it's like play at work hard, play hard. So, and you know, when you really put effort, there's no relaxation. And when you relax, there's no effort. But what we're trying to develop is this balance where there is effort and relaxation together. Now, if you meditate, if there's too much effort, you get immediate feedback. You get tense. Your breathing is not so relaxed and it's not so natural. You get headache or constriction in your chest. So this is your body telling you, you know, you haven't got that balance right yet. If you're too relaxed, what happens? You either go off into a daydream or you fall asleep. So this is the body telling you again, you know, you haven't got that balance right. So these problems that arise, they can also be seen as part of this feedback system. So it's actually a very good thing. When you're getting tense, yeah, relax a little bit. When you're too relaxed, put a little bit more effort and seeing what works, trying. How do you just very subtly increase that energy just a little bit, just tweak it just a little bit, just relax just a little bit. Yeah, this is something that we need to learn as a meditation skill. So there's so many things to learn. I mean, I've been talking for longer than I intended to already, but I guess that my message to what I'm really trying to put over is don't get into this like, I'm not a good meditator. I can't do this. It's too, you know, I was some people get, you know, first year I meditated, I had these wonderful experiences. It was, and you know, I just can't get back there. And these kind of sad meditators, you know, it's just, you know, that first meditation retreat, you know, and when can I ever experience that again? Will I ever again? But it's learning. You can learn from your meditation, whatever, you know, whether there are hindrances or not hindrances. And seeing that you're growing, and so you're developing effort, you're developing patience, you're developing skills of dealing with the mind, you're understanding how to work with the mind. These are all very important things to learn. So this is the talk that I'd like to offer this evening.